Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So tonight marks the fifth week into the Vasa retreat. As I mentioned last week, the passing of time can be a useful perception for us, particularly as we're striving to practice. We really have to remember that this opportunity is a very rare opportunity that we have to be in retreat and have supportive conditions. And it's quite easy to fall into, you know, kind of fall out of balance, really. Practice is, we have to find the right balance of effort. If there's too much effort and too much striving, we get tense and overshoot the mark. But if there's not enough effort and kind of falling to the other side to little bit of complacency, then we fall short of the mark. So practice is actually a lot about finding the right balance internally and externally, finding the right balance in terms of our application of effort, in terms of our responses to things. We don't always get it right, but again, as I mentioned previously, we need to learn from when we don't get it right. We need to learn from when things aren't going so well. It's not as if it's wrong, there's no one to blame, but we need to learn what's helpful and what's not helpful, what leads in the right direction. And what doesn't lead in that direction. And we can only learn this through understanding the results of our practice on this very mind, on this very heart. And be careful when I say learning from the results. It doesn't mean that if you're not getting jhana, or if you're not, you know, got your samadhi all together, that you're getting it wrong. It's not necessarily that, but you know when you are making the right kind of effort, you see even just small results in the effect in your mind with what you're experiencing. So it may be that you're working with a lot of disturbing emotions, but you'll be able to know, you're the one who knows the way you deal with that or engage with that. Does it create more disturbing emotions, or does it somehow allow you to see into the nature of what's happening? Does it, your practice with it, allow you to come to some measure of calm in relation to the experience? It may not be immediate, but it may be through some application of effort or application of insight or right view that you're, you know, in a few moments or a few hours or even a day or more, you'll see something change. This is so important, to keep watching the mind and watching the input, what you're putting into your experience, in terms of the results that it brings back. As I say, it's not necessarily always immediate, but when the results do come back, even if it's delayed in time, you'll know that it's a result of skillful practice or a result of maybe getting out of balance, putting in too much striving or not enough striving, or merely just indulging mind states or moods or frittering away one's time and just letting the mind, you know, wander all over the place and not really bother much with it. So learning from the results of our practice is really where wisdom develops. So having the opportunity for a longer retreat to look at this feedback loop in the mind over a longer period in terms of your practice is really helpful. And having a situation that's supported with reducing contact, reducing talking, reducing activities, it doesn't come around often. It's very rare that we have these conditions coming together. And many people want those conditions, and even though they make effort towards them, they don't necessarily come to fruition. There were many people who were originally booked to come to be here for the Vassa, and for one reason or another, life intervened and it didn't happen, you know. So for those of us that are here and have this opportunity, it's helpful to recollect, as we do in the 10 subjects for frequent recollection, the days and nights are relentlessly passing. How well am I spending my time? This is so important, not to get uptight or get distraught over anything, but to make the best of one's time too. It's so easy just to fall into habitual ways of being, especially when things are relatively comfortable. We have good conditions and good comfort here to support the practice. And it's kind of easy to slip into a bit of complacency or just general mode of being without recognizing, hang on, you know, time is slipping away. Before we know it, the Vassa will be over. Before we know it, our life will be over. It's just like that. We really don't know how long we've got, each of us. So this recollection of the days and nights are relentlessly passing helps us to make the most of this opportunity of being human, of having supportive conditions to practice. We're not in a war-torn country. We have abundance of requisites. We have the Buddha's teaching on tap, you know, wherever you look, in the library, on the internet, and to, you know, these talks or other talks, there's so much Dharma available these days. And I'm not sure where it was, whether it was in the suttas or some commentaries, but there's this metaphor for the rare occurrence of a human birth. We'll take it to another scale here. You know, just to be born human is apparently incredibly rare opportunity. And it's compared to, if you imagine a ring, somewhat like a life-saving ring floating on the surface of the ocean, one ring on the surface of the ocean, how likely is it that a turtle in that ocean would pop its head up through that ring? Pretty unlikely. So this is compared to the likelihood of a human birth is, you know, a very rare occurrence. So this serves to kind of help just generate some energy and generate some wakefulness and to seize the opportunity that we have to practice the Buddha's teaching. It's not for anyone else or for any other reason, but to recognize, you know, this birth, this life that we find ourselves in. We do become very habituated to the situation and our habitat, if you like, and we lose awareness of the inevitability of death and the fact that we really don't know what happens after death. The Buddha teaches that, you know, as long as we're still bound by ignorance and fettered by craving, that beings take birth again and again according to their karma. And this is called the cycle of samsara, birth and death endlessly. Now at least I don't, and I expect most of us here don't have direct insight or direct vision into our past lives or into the vision of how beings are born, die from this realm and born again into another realm, as the Buddha had these visions on the night of his enlightenment. I don't expect we have that direct insight ourselves, but for myself I can see very clearly how this continuity of being would continue on. The power of habit, the power of karma, the power of craving is so present. It's such a force in one's life that with the dropping away of this body, I can easily understand how this force would continue and find new birth, find new conditions for birth. The power of this karma, this craving, this consciousness. So waking up out of this, waking up out of this habitual mode of being, waking up and recognizing what it is we're doing, what it is we're engaging with in this life, why it is we're doing what we're doing. Remembering what brought us to this path, this whole experience of dukkha, the first noble truth, that it's, you know, for us in a very comfortable environment at the moment and a safe, relatively safe environment, there's not a lot impinging, so it's quite easy for us. Perhaps we could say it's a little bit of a deva realm. It's quite pleasant, you know, so it's easy to get a little bit complacent. You don't always have a lot of experience of dukkha. And the Buddha said that a human realm, at least I think the Buddha was purported to have said it, was actually the best situation for awakening, because there's a good balance of pleasure and pain, relatively speaking. Obviously, there's lots of human situations where there's much more pain than we have it here. But there's a relative amount of a balance for beings to learn how to contemplate, to really look into their experience of suffering, because it's not so in our face, it's not so intense that we just haven't got the opportunity to contemplate and investigate into the nature of this experience. So in many ways we have this ideal opportunity. So it's important to reflect on that, not to get distraught by it or upset by it, but to reflect, how balanced is my effort, how balanced is my energy. We don't want to overreach, we don't want to strive so much that we create more tension in a way. It's not about that, it's about waking up really, waking up to the opportunity and remembering. Very much an aspect of mindfulness is remembering, what are we doing here? What's this about? Am I making the best of this opportunity? And we can reflect like this just from moment to moment in our meditation practice as we get caught up in memories and planning, which is the habitual mode. We can reflect, hang on, what am I doing? Come back to here and now. What is it to make the most of this opportunity in each moment in sitting? Am I encouraging one-pointedness in this mind? Am I working to establish mindfulness in the body, recognizing, feeling the pain or the pleasure of each experience? Am I examining what the mind state is? Am I recognizing when the mind is influenced by desire, or when the mind is affected by anger or ill will, or when there's doubt present, or when there's restlessness present, or when there's dullness present? This is the third foundation of mindfulness. Or am I recognizing when there's one-pointedness, when the mind actually comes into a still place, to continue to recognize the factors of meditation that are there? And when one gets knocked out of that still place due to latching onto a memory or something else disturbing us, to keep knowing what's happening. The mind has lost one-pointedness. Mind has latched onto a memory. Mind feels disturbed. One feels upset. To know this clearly for what it is, not to get upset about the one-pointedness being lost. Or if you get upset, to know it for what it is. This is creating a continuity in your practice. And when you're not in formal practice, it doesn't mean your practice stops. You keep the observing mind going, keep knowing what's going on in the mind, what's happening in the body. Stay with the process of this mind-body experience as much as possible. When we know what's happening in the mind, without judgment, but with discernment, when we know, we have the opportunity to bring in some balancing factors where possible. So if anger arises in the mind or disturbance arises in the mind, we know it as it is. How can we balance that out? What's needed here to help balance? And when I say balance, it's about, because what we're encouraging is to create a certain balance and stillness in the mind. Even though that which observes, that which knows, it can know when things are out of balance. But in terms of settling the mind, in terms of developing samatha and vipassana, it's always helpful to work towards bringing some stillness in, or bringing in qualities that will help to balance and return the mind to some measure of stillness. And this is also when we get to know when there's boredom in the mind, to know when the mind, when attention starts searching for something to do. I'm a bit bored with this now. And you feel a sense of distractedness. The mind is distracted. This is also an aspect of citta satipatthana. Is the mind distracted or is it one-pointed? If you know it's distracted, you have an opportunity to not only experience that fully and feel the dukkha of it, but to also engage it skillfully. You engage it skillfully, maybe through letting go of the object which it's become focused on, which has become an object for distraction, or engage it in some other way. That's for you to know and to learn from and decide. But to make yourself sensitive to when the mind and the body is becoming out of balance, when the mind is beginning to seek and latch on to things that are disturbing. It could just be subtly disturbing or grossly disturbing, but to know that gives you an opportunity to bring it back into balance. And part of mindfulness and clear comprehension is recognizing the context of our experience. So within meditation, a meditation context, the meditation sittings, what we choose to do may be quite different than if we find this happening while we're washing up or doing some activity, because it's dependent on the context. In meditation, generally you want to intervene in very appropriate ways. It could be very subtle ways so as to allow disturbance to cease. If there's too much effort, you bring too much energy into the mind. So it has to be very subtle, depending on what's happening, of course. If there's a murderous thought arising, maybe it's not so subtle, you have to suppress it if you're about to throttle someone. But generally speaking. So for us, remembering the context of this retreat, the context of this precious opportunity, the precious human rebirth they talk about in the Tibetan tradition, as something to recollect, because it reminds us this opportunity doesn't come along easily. For myself, when this the opportunity to ordain again for a second time in my life, that was one of the most compelling thoughts in my mind, was, well, how rare is this opportunity? Many people don't get the opportunity to do it once in their life, but here it's coming, being offered to me again. And so something in me rose up very strongly to that. So just recognizing context, recognizing the opportunity we have, and, you know, using that or recalling that attitude as much as possible is something that will bring energy to your practice. Again, whether it's formal meditation in sitting or walking, or, you know, walking between your kuti and the house, or engaging your work mindfully, to recollect each and every moment is an opportunity for knowing what's happening in this body-mind, and for engaging that opportunity skillfully, bringing each factor of the Eightfold Path. And you don't have to do that conceptually, because actually just recollecting that opportunity is a part of right view. Once you've brought your attention to the present, you can reflect on what's happening in the mind-body. You're already establishing right view. With right view established, if you're seeing, is there dukkha present? How is there craving present? How can I relate to this skillfully? You're establishing all the factors of the path right there. So the factors of the Eightfold Path, you know, you get samadhitti, samasankappa, or right view, right thought, right speech. This word that gets used to translate samma in English is right. It's not necessarily the best translation. Samma, there's many different possibilities with the word samma. And for some people, the word right can be a bit triggering, because if we're not getting it right, we must be getting it wrong, yeah? And it can make you a bit uptight, thinking, I've got to get it right. And right seems like such a pragmatic word, and it's a bit, it reminds me of the kind of carrot and stick prompt, you know. If you don't get it right, you might get punished. Or so there are other words which I find a bit more evocative. Some people talk about the, you know, completion, complete view, or full view, which is full or right. But some of these meanings related to sama, one of them I recall is about these, what makes it right is that they're going, these factors, these qualities of practice and mind are all going in the right direction, or in one direction, that is, towards Nibbana. They're right because they're moving together in one direction. They're moving in one path. They're going one way only. So it's a bit like the, you know, the road to Bundanoon. If you turn left out of Coal Mines Road, you're not going in the right direction. So we can say it's wrong, and turning right, you're going in the right direction. It's right because you want to get to Bundanoon, so you've taken the right action to get there. But it, the word is also glossed with other meanings. One is that these factors are moving together in harmony, move together in one direction. So I find that helpful, you know, that it's not just black and white about right or wrong, but it's about establishing a direction that's actually working for you, working for you to attain, to get to where you want to go. So I don't know if that's helpful to reflect on, but when I was reflecting on sama in my own practice years ago, it was very helpful for me. And just like the word kusala, which gets translated as skillful or wholesome, as opposed to unskillful or unwholesome, which is akusala. It's skillful, you know, we cultivate skillful qualities of mind. They're skillful because they go, again, they lead to Nibbana. They lead away from suffering. They don't lead towards suffering. So when you reflect in your own heart and mind about what's present and the kind of qualities you're developing and you're bringing to each moment, instead of just thinking right or wrong or good or bad, to reflect, is this moving in the direction of lessening suffering? Is this moving in the direction of Nibbana? In that sense, it kind of, it rises a little bit above the duality of right and wrong and good and bad. Is it just moving in the direction of lessening suffering, allaying suffering, to Nibbana, to cooling, to release? That's what we need to know in our practice. So I'll just leave you with these few words of encouragement tonight.